Welcome to Your Path to Nonprofit Leadership, the weekly podcast that provides you with the insights and strategies to excel on your nonprofit leadership journey. I'm your host, Patton McDowell, and thrilled to have you join me for another enlightening conversation. Now, this episode is sponsored by PMA's Mastermind Leadership Development Program, now accepting applications for the 2024 summer and fall cohorts. Now, if you're ready to elevate your leadership in your current role or perhaps prepare you for your next one, this is the place for you to be. Join our national community of nonprofit leaders by going to the Mastermind page at PMANonprofit.com to learn more and apply today. Well, I'm excited to share this conversation with you. This is episode number 256 of Your Path to Nonprofit Leadership, and I was joined by Carol Bowser, the founder of Conflict Management Strategies. Now, sadly, as a nonprofit leader, you are going to have to deal with conflict. That is a skill set you need to develop. And Carol brings the expertise on managing conflict within nonprofit organizations. And she offers valuable insights to help leaders like you foster an environment of open communication and greater collaboration. Without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Carol Bowser. Carol, thank you for joining me on The Path.
My pleasure to be here.
I'm excited about this conversation, although the topic you are the perfect expert to talk about is not something that nonprofit leaders look forward to, and that is managing conflict. But the reality of all leaders is that they are going to have to deal with it, and you are the perfect person to talk to. So, Carol, I'm excited to have you on the podcast to talk about it. And why don't we start with a broad question, if you will. What are some of the primary causes you see in workplace conflicts, especially maybe with the nuance of the nonprofit sector?
So I think that there's a couple of, you know, universal themes, you know, with conflict, and whether we want to call it conflict or not feeling great or frustration or tension or disappointment. I think that the common theme that runs across is unmet expectations. And particularly in the nonprofit world, where it's so mission driven. And I think a lot of people go into, you know, the work and then choose to be in the nonprofit sector because they really want to make an impact. And sometimes there may be systems or policies or processes or people where it's like, you know, this wasn't what I expected the work to be. And it may be an expectation of I wanted to do more outward facing work, and I'm finding my time is doing more administrative stuff, and that's not why I went into this sector. That's not why I went into, you know, the nonprofit world. And so I often say, you know, if we can help kind of uncover what the unmet expectations were, and then be able to look at those and figure out, you know, what's going on, what can be done. I think that's huge in the nonprofit sector in particular, because it is so hearts and minds and really wanting to make an impact, and a lot of very, very dedicated people on like a visceral level to the work.
You capture that perfectly, and you're so right. Not that every job doesn't have passion behind it, but I do think our sector is full of individuals who come at it with an expectation of making a difference. And so when they don't feel that perhaps as quickly as they'd like, you're right. I think that can create an environment for disappointment and some of the other terms you used, whether conflict is the most intense, but it's not as fulfilling as they'd like. So before we unpack, you know, other causes behind this, and maybe more importantly, how to deal with it, how did you get into this work, Carol, in particular conflict resolution?
Well, looking back, I think a lot of careers, if you look in kind of the rearview mirror, there's a bit of a path there. So I started out doing work in mediation before I went to law school. I wanted to go to law school thinking about making a difference and helping work, you know, make improvements in the workplace. And I thought, you know, at first I'm like, I don't want to be a judge. And then I figured out, you know, where judges spend the majority of their time. Like, ah. But I took a mediation course through a local community mediation center where they were talking about people's values and helping people find a voice and find a structure to be able to resolve issues. And what was really meaningful for me is, can you imagine how bad a situation would have to be where you would pick up a phone, call complete strangers, be able to say, this is impacting my life, I need help, and then sit down in a meeting room with someone who is impacting your life, maybe derailing your life, causing, you know, emotional turbulence, maybe financial issues, and then with a stranger to try to work it out. And I found that process of learning about conflict and about resolution and about communication and helping people organize their thoughts and articulate their thoughts and problem solve, even when they think they shouldn't have to, you know, it's right, a principle of the right. thing, we shouldn't have to do this. And then I went to law school and I practiced law for a little bit, and the practicing law, it gets very, very far away from that immediacy of working with someone and having them be engaged and an active participant in the dispute resolution process and ultimately in whatever the agreements for the resolution of the process are. And I think, you know, echoing back to what we had, you know, talked about at the beginning of what I thought it was going to be, kind of what the expectation was, and then what the day-to-day reality of that was, particularly given the area of practice that that I was interested in, there was a disconnect for that. And I found that doing my work about teaching and training and coaching and mediating, you know, and group facilitation, it's much more in line with how can I provide, you know, a structure and a framework for people to be able to have a voice, articulate what they need, and be an active participant in the process. And then ultimately, hopefully, fingers crossed, you know, knock on wood, feel as though the process for moving through issues that are sticky and impactful was something that they were engaged in, and also that they'd be more engaged in fulfilling what the outcome is.
Such a valuable skill and processes I know you bring to individuals and organizations with which you work. Well, how does your practice now kind of manifest itself? What type of work do you do? And I know it could apply to any organization, but certainly we'll talk about nonprofits in particular.
So for nonprofits, there is sometimes conflict in nonprofits. And so sometimes it is at the board level where the board is clunky. I'll just use the word kind of clunky. And it may be because we've got new volunteers coming in. It may be that they don't have their own developed kind of systems and processes of how we do stuff, how we make decision, how we handle dissent, how we utilize our time, how we balance between the go-getters and the just showing uppers, how we balance with, you know, the people who are also donors. And in some nonprofits, the people that are on the board are also utilizing the services. Sometimes it's the relationship between the executive director and the board, and sometimes it's like, hey, maybe the executive director needs a little bit of coaching. Sometimes it's working with the high level management. If there's kind of, again, clunkiness within the management team, sometimes it's, you know, kind of group work with them. And then sometimes it's, we've got key people who are not getting along or that they're clashing. And sometimes it's, you know, training for like staff. And then sometimes it's, you know, mediating disputes and points of tension between, you know, key individuals. And those key individuals can be at director level. Those key individuals could be, you know, key staff people going through. So training, mediating, facilitating, coaching, kind of at all of the different levels.
Yeah. And I'm nodding, and I bet our listeners are too, Carol, because every scenario you described, every situation is likely has happened and or certainly could happen. And that's what you can bring to the table. I guess, have you found certain causes or maybe sectors within the nonprofit community that you particularly enjoy working? I know it applies in every direction, but I'm wondering, curious about what you personally have enjoyed working with?
So that's a big question, because I look at like some of my clients, and like some of what we call kind of nonprofit is also in healthcare. And there is a lot of different things in healthcare going in there, then also, you know, in human services, of being able to get, you know, people who are highly passionate, you know, about the work. Behavioral health, that's another one. And also, I've gotten a chance to work with some really cool, some in the more business focused, you know, sector, you know, tourism bureaus and different things like that, that are, you know, non-profits, and thus, you know, report to boards, and you have that, you know, that structure. And so, sometimes, again, it's kind of, sometimes the themes are a little bit universal. Some are more kind of the human services, human element focused, and some are more the revenue helping business focus. And I find that each is fascinating in its own way. And I feel like I learn a lot. And because I go across industries, one of the advantages is, you know, and even with government and, you know, private sector and quasi, you know, municipal type of stuff. And I can look at them truthfully in the eye and I said, you are not alone. I see this a lot. Even the places that are best places to work or top places to work or things like that. And I think that provides a bit of solace. So if anyone is listening and you're saying, I'm struggling with this conflict, or I'm struggling with, you know, a key volunteer, or I'm struggling, you know, trying to keep everybody happy, which on a side note, you should not be trying to keep everybody happy.
Yeah, we'll come back to that.
I think let's shift it to like, let's keep them at least content rather than happy. Being able to say you aren't alone in this, and being able to kind of provide examples of how other people have done it. Because I think if people can see themselves and others, because conflict is hugely isolating.
Right.
You know, I've had employees when I start talking to them and I talk about common themes and common concerns that come up, they're like, oh, God, I thought I was the only one. Because a lot of times, and here's a tip for the executive directors, people will retreat into silence. You know, and I think silence and isolation is a breeding ground for pain and disconnection. And that kind of drives conflict. So you may have people, you know, we use the term quiet quitting, but there's this, like, I'm disengaged and I'm going to give minimal effort. I'm going to look for another job. There's another one of, I am sitting in a place of pain and I feel alone. That's something different.
Well, that's a perfect segue to one of the questions I was going to ask you about. Identifying some of the characteristics of a workplace that maybe is not healthy. And you're right, conflict is not always loud, is it? Or easily apparent, because it may be the quiet nature of your office. If I'm a nonprofit leader, I guess, Carol, that was the way I was going to phrase the question. What are some of the characteristics I need to look for that might, you know, frankly, be a warning sign?
So I'm going to give a little preview. I think that there's a great book out there called Crucial Conversations. And one of the things that they talk about, their principles, is they talk about, like, people retreat into silence, or in their words, violence, meaning, you know, people just get really kind of agitated, more assertive, maybe even aggressive, of trying to speak in order to get their needs met. So there's like a tool embedded inside an observation of that. If people are talking to more people more loudly, it means that they don't feel heard. And I find that in nonprofit, you know, that are very mission-driven organizations, and people that are really drawn to be able to do the work, if they feel that their ability to do the work is being impeded by someone or something, some people can be very, very vocal about that.
Right.
On the other hand, in the last several years, in some of the organizations that I have worked with that are the human services, and particularly those that may focus on people where they feel that there are power imbalances going on, you know, whether it's mental health or providing resources for underserved populations, that a lot of people have, and a lot of organizations recognize that their people, including their employees, have had past trauma in their life, whether that's poverty or abuse or unstable home or different things like that. And so a lot of them, they will say we're trying to institute a trauma-informed approach and a trauma-informed culture. And so some of it, it's even like, well, people are bringing that into work. And even, here's another little thing, even if they are human-based services, they may not do the same skill sets with each other that they do with their clients of like active listening and being able to participate, you know, participatory decision-making and things like that. So I think that is one. So again, we kind of go from, you know, the language of crucial conversations to kind of, you know, violence and like really, really assertive to being, you know, withdrawing. And it's hard because people are people, you know, people are messy and you're just trying to figure out, you know, who you're bringing in and what you're asking of them to support the internal culture. And I think that's a big challenge. That's a big people management challenge, and particularly leadership. Like you're trying to run and grow an organization and meet all of the demands of the organization, including, you know, reporting to your board of directors, who may be a very naive board of directors. And so you're kind of trying to manage all of that. And I think also that as a leader, you have to start relying on your managers and supervisors to kind of be your eyes and ears for that. And being able to spend some time talking about, like, you know, what do we know about our people? You know, what are their expectations of each other? What are their expectations of us as an employer, particularly given we're mission driven? And how are we articulating that? Or is everybody kind of making up their own idea of what other people should be doing? That was a long answer to your question, but I think that's a big part of it.
It's a good one. I'm glad you underlined crucial conversations, which may or may not be a book that you lift up later, I realize, but it's a good one. And I appreciate the coaching too, because that was a question I was going to ask you. All right. I'm a nonprofit leader listening, Carol, and I want to be better at this. And I'm struck by, of course, one of the points you just made, that I need to be a good listener, I guess, or observant of those examples of either violent language or silence. Are there other skills, if you're coaching me as a leader, that I ought to develop if I want to be better at this kind of thing?
Oh, there's so many. The first one that comes to my mind is I see a lot of leaders, you know, they really want to be liked. And you're, as a leader, you have to make decisions in the best interest of the organization, which may be contrary to the best interest of an individual or an individual team. And I think particularly if we want to be liked, or we want to be respected, or we are ourselves are uncomfortable with high degrees of emotion and we're seeking harmony, and we really want everyone to be happy, that is just, that's an impossible, that is so aspirational that I don't know how you get there. And I find that most of the complaints I see with nonprofit directors is that they want to be liked by everybody.
Good
and
point.
They want everybody to be happy. So that way they aren't having the conversations that they need to have. And then also they may be hiring managers and supervisors and directors who are great with the mission, but lack supervisory skills. And they don't want to have those conversations either. So then the executive director ends up, you know, in this weird place of they want to be liked, they want people to be happy, but then nobody's holding people accountable. So then they're painted into the position of feeling like they're the bad guy.
Such a good point. And I'm struck by that because, you know, so many of these causes, as you mentioned earlier, it's a feel good cause, right? And I think particularly folks that have come into the sector, maybe as a volunteer, which was a really feel good experience, right? If I'm volunteering for a cause that I believe in, and then I get into the work environment, it's not always fun and feel good. And so you're saying, though, we have to be careful about the expectation of keeping constant harmony, because there will be difficult situations, I guess, and hard work ahead. And if I'm going to lead, it's not always going to be, you know, just happy-go-lucky.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the decision should be, you know, kind of how can we support the people to help the organization? Do you see what I mean? Of like making that link explicit.
Right.
Of like, how can I help you in a way that's going to make you successful in your job, but ultimately to support the organization? And I think that last part of the conversation is left out. And notice I didn't say, and how we support those who we serve, because it's like, if we kind of skip over that, then it's constantly focused on, you know, the beneficiary of the nonprofit, and not recognizing that this is, you know, kind of a living being. You know, there are systems, there are processes, there are regulations, there are reporting requirements, there is fiduciary duty, there are levels of confidentiality. And I think that some people who get into nonprofit work have a strange relationship, or an interesting relationship, or a ongoing, everyone has an ongoing relationship with power, but also kind of with money. And if, like, we don't like talking about money, we don't like raising money, we don't like asking for money, there's like, well, the money allows the organization to be there. And indeed, I'm also seeing with work with organizations that want to dismantle power structures, they have an interesting relationship with power. But in organizations, different people are designated to make different types of decisions.
Yes. So good. And as a former fundraiser, I can very much appreciate the difference. The psychology is around money, right? We bring some of that baggage to our jobs. But yes, as a nonprofit, we need investment to achieve our mission. And so that is an interesting and often power-laced dynamic. I guess a two-part question, Carol, is because you've alluded to this as well. Creating an environment, I guess, that is transparent, right? As a leader, I guess I need to make clear that everything's not going to go perfectly, and we're going to have to accept the fact that conflict will sometimes occur. And so advice on how do we create an environment that is as healthy as it can be? And then I want to move to, all right, once a conflict does occur, how can I best resolve it? So setting the stage and then resolving conflict, could you comment on both?
Sure. So in the first situation, I'll give the audience, you know, a technique that I use in all of my trainings, because sometimes I do training around conflict and power, and sometimes it's around, you know, respectful conversations and maybe some compliance issues around, you know, harassment and discrimination. And I always say, like, I just want to put out there that we have X number of different life experiences in the room. We have, you know, even if we all choose to be here, it doesn't, and we share similar values, it doesn't mean that we are lockstep, that everybody thinks those values are demonstrated in the exact same way.
Right.
And I also say that I want to recognize that some of your needs are going to be the shared, some of your needs are going to be different, and some of your needs are going to be competing. And that's on an individual level, that's on a team level, and that's kind of, you know, on an organizational level. And particularly for an executive director, you are constantly managing and trying to identify shared needs, differing needs, and sometimes navigating competing needs. And I think just being able to say that, if we recognize this, and we're hiring you for your brain to be able to execute, and when there are differing opinions, we want to understand what the differing opinion is. You notice that's different than, hey, if you have a problem with someone, I want you to go and talk to them directly about it, versus just saying that, and we frame it in terms of kind of differing needs and differing wants. And first being able to have managers and supervisors at all levels talk about, are we identifying what the shared needs are, what the differing needs are, what potentially competing needs are, you know, within those, and then being able to craft a path, whether we all call it a strategic plan or goal setting or managing that, being able to have, you know, discussions or brainstorming pieces about it. And I think that that's a way of making it seem more approachable versus, if you have a problem with someone, go and talk to them.
Right. Which could make it worse, right?
People are like, no, I don't want to. And very few organizations will make you. Right. So,
well, in quick interjection there, because what you just described could make it worse, right? You're creating a better, a healthier level of expectation, because I bet many individuals come into an organization thinking, all right, well, I guess I'm supposed to take my concern or my differences to that individual. And is that what you've seen, Carol, and that gets worse or makes it worse?
I think that that people are so reluctant to be able to bring up conversations because it's like they're not, it's not worth the emotional investment. It's a little bit too risky, and it's risky because I don't know how the other person is going to react to it. And particularly because there are power structures in organizations. And as you know, a leader, you do have power. Whether and how you choose to exercise it is something different. However, people don't want to get on their boss's bad side. And also, if people see a power vacuum, what's the old saying? Nature abhors a vacuum. So if they don't see you stepping in and leading and making decisions, they're going to take the reins themselves. Right. And particularly if you have a void there and you try to put in a supervisor, dollars to donuts, they're going to say, we are fine without a supervisor. We are fine without a manager. We were able to function. Thank you very much. So it's almost like super empowerment, but then it's like, well, the point of a manager is to be able to, you know, help support people, field training, translate strategic objectives into tasks and get systems and processes in place. So, you know, it's kind of undervaluing the manager in that respect.
It's a good example. And well, you've given several, and I think you and I'll talk about a couple more. But let me jump to the one, again, every leader has had to contemplate, and let's put it in the context of maybe two members of my senior team. They're not getting along, and perhaps it has bubbled into an even more aggressive, violent language-laced conflict. What do I do? What do I do if I'm faced with that kind of dilemma?
Okay. So if you ever hear the words, they just need to stay in their lane, you have got a problem.
Good to know.
And also, one of the things that I see, and I think some of your other guests might have mentioned this, is like, do you have an understanding about where one job ends and the other begins? And I see that kind of, you know, at the senior leadership level. So for example, finance touches everything. Yes. HR touches everything. If you have diversity, equity, and inclusion person, that touches everything. So if you touch everything, like, where does it stop? Does somebody need to be included in everything? You know, who gets to make certain decisions? Who is consulted in certain decisions? And I think when we talk about collaboration, and particularly if we want like a flat organization and we want everyone to get together, I think that that providing a certain amount of structure of who gets the default, that's kind of, you know, important. And I'll go back to, you may have somebody who's a real go-getter and is going. And there may be some people who want a more methodical approach, and they may have different ways of doing things. And sometimes if I, oh my goodness, if I hear someone say they're adults, they should be able to figure it out. My internal response is, if they are adults and they could do this on their own, don't you think they would have done so already? And that be a big flashing light that they are expecting you as a leader to come in and say, we have two competing points of view. It seems like some needs are shared and these seem competing, that there are competing ways of doing this. There are competing ways of thinking. And each one of you is advocating for your way. Then this is too disruptive. As the leader of the organization, this is the way that I want it to be done. And I feel compelled to say this. It's like, if you're large enough to have a chief operating officer, you know, that's supposed to be someone who's, you know, internally focused, and maybe the executive director, that their work has to be externally focused of building goodwill within the community, making connections, you know, testifying, you know, lobbying and different things like that. And it's really hard to be the outward face when you're trying to do the inward stuff as well. And particularly if there's a disconnect between the, you know, executive director and the chief operating officer, it can get a little wonky. That's a big conflict, because then who are they supposed to go to?
Exactly.
You know, well, they're going to go to the executive, you know, director, because it's, you know, it's your circus, it's your monkeys, you know, and they're going to say, I need you to get this other monkey in control.
Well, let's say again, if the circus doesn't have the two senior levels, is it in your opinion, is if I'm the senior executive, two of my colleagues are in conflict, is it my responsibility to mediate that to some extent? In other words, I've seen on more than one occasion, Carol, the exasperated executive say to the two colleagues, you two go figure it out. I'm tired of hearing both of you complain, likely complaining about each other to you directly. Yeah. And so I think, I guess it's to your point earlier, right? Well, you're adults, so you two go figure it out. But in fact, should I, as a leader, sit down with both of them together and try to force it to work out?
I've got competing feelings about that. Sure. One is, you know, I'm thinking of a, you know, maybe a situation where there's like a CFO and, you know, and HR or something like that, where you have kind of maybe foundationally different ways of doing things. Then you also have, that's one piece, but I'm also thinking about a situation where maybe it's just colleagues. We're saying, look, the two of you are having a disagreement, you know, and also being able to say, and this disagreement is impacting the entire leadership team.
Right.
I think there can be informal, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of diplomats, you know, the diplomats, like part of your job is to kind of be able to increase communication. And I think maybe a great question is like, you know, where's the blockage here? You know, and, you know, is it a difference of opinion, or we just don't like the other person, you know,
right.
How they do their job.
Right.
Maybe it's like, you know, they're not doing their job. You know, that's really hard when colleagues feel like somebody else isn't doing their job. So then that might be, you know, a discussion with the leader of, this is what I'm seeing the job is. This is what I, going back to unmet expectations, this is my expectation of how this particular person was going to focus on this. This is my particular expectations of where the boundaries of decision-making are. You know, we're going to need some guidance. I think where the boundaries are really clear, that can be easy. It's where the gray area is of like, how do we want to navigate that? It can be difficult. So you can be kind of an informal mediator of, you know, trying to bring people together of like, say, you know, can we go get some coffee, you know, the three of us together, because this situation is impacting me. I'm hearing both of you feel, you don't want to say both of you complaining about each other, but you
could
say,
like,
you could say something very diplomatic of, it feels like each one of you feels stymied by the situation and feels really frustrated with the situation. So we're not saying it's the situation. And we could say, you know, let's figure out a way that we can identify what the concerns are and see if there is a path forward, because this is one of my favorite phrases. I think I made it up. Maybe if I didn't,
we'll give you credit for it.
But causing organizational drag of people are looking at the leaders and they see this, and it trickles down to how your departments work. It trickles down, and people very easily lose confidence in the leader's competence if this stuff is just unresolved. That can be really difficult. And I mean, I think even leaders can sit down and say, I can talk to you. But again, sometimes it's like the problem is the leader, because they don't want to step in and they don't want to be involved.
Exactly.
I've seen this a lot that the leaders will say, if I'm getting involved in this, I'm doing their job. And if I have to do their job, I don't need them. I need somebody who can do their job. And then I see other people to the leaders of saying they are just conflict avoidant and they won't step in. And so in the last year, I think it's like, you know, being able to have the conversation of, are you wanting or expecting me to step in and address an issue? Because I'm viewing it as the two of you need to figure out how to run your departments and run them in a way that doesn't interfere with each other. So it's like kind of, it's almost like people standing on the edge of a pool and looking at each other and go, you go first. No, you go first. I'm not going first. You go first. And so I think it's even if they're, I can't tell you how many times I've heard, I can't, they're not doing their job. And if they're not doing their job, you know, why do I even have them here? So, you know, maybe put your, transport yourself into their position of what's going on where they don't, where they seem locked in, and, or is there something in the situation where they are wanting you to step in and provide direction or some type of executive level decision-making?
Right. Two things I have to underscore, and not surprisingly, you're very good at using language, modeling language that strikes me both as clarifying in a situation like one we're talking about, de-escalating, and the importance of language, again, which I know you teach and coach very well. Also, I noticed that getting people out of their environment where perhaps the conflict occurs, and you tell me, but that always has struck me. Let's get out of the office. Let's go somewhere and have coffee. Does, in fact, that change of environment, you think, create a better opportunity for resolution?
Yes, and I think there's, I can't quote it, but I remember hearing like some various research or gurus or something saying that if you kind of want a different endpoint, change where you are.
Right.
Because I'll go back to power dynamics. There are power dynamics in the workplace. Whose office are you doing? You know,
good point.
Are you in a conference room where somebody else can overhear? But then also, usually changing location changes thinking. And there's an adage, I can't remember where I heard this, but like if you want people to think differently, have the meeting standing up, because people will go back to their same place, take their same posture, and will kind of get into the same thinking. So it's like a subtle way to shake things up a little bit. You know, you hear people go outside for a walk, you know, little asterisk if there are disability issues or things like that, or like you're compelling people to walk at your pace.
Good point.
You know,
yeah.
As a mediator, I look at like, how is the environment giving a message that everyone is an equitable participant in the process?
Right.
Even if there are power structures. So again, you know, maybe changing how we're doing, are we kind of getting out of the positional? And also if you go out to lunch, people are a bit likely on their best behavior in front of strangers, and they don't want to look like an idiot in front of the serving staff.
Right.
And they may not raise their voice as much because there are social protocols that people start engaging in. I think that that's something interesting. However, if you're a remote team and you need to do it over, you know, a camera and the, you know, electronics, then, you know, you take it where you can get it, you know, going through. And I think that that's interesting. So if you can't maybe change the modality, maybe you change the approach. Like if you're asking the same question over and over again, sometimes I think of like, how can I turn this question on its head? You know, how can I flip it on its head? I think it was like Mark Twain who said, you know, the same thinking that caused a problem isn't going to be the same thinking that changes it.
Indeed.
So it's like being able to say of like, you know, what are we missing or what are we overlooking about this situation? Like if we could flip this on its head, how could we describe it? You know, what's a really compelling question we could ask each other that that might provide some insight, you know, things like that versus what, like reiterating the same narrative over and over and over and over again about how someone's acting like a intransigent, or they're not doing their job, or they're not competent, or they're not making a decision, or things like that.
Fantastic, Carol, as you have been throughout this conversation, lots of great takeaways for our listeners who I'm sure are tuning in because they want to do a better job of creating an environment for healthy interaction and obviously better dealing with conflict when it occurs. Any final advice for someone listening around those topics or anything you'd want them to take away?
Yeah, that I think unresolved conflict is a point of pain, and we don't want chronic pain. You know, maybe one day you stub your toe, that's one kind of pain. Another day you bump your elbow, that's something different. But, you know, not really kind of addressing this unmet expectations, you know, and having people stay in points of pain or discomfort or dissatisfaction or stress or anxiety, I don't think that's good. So my one kind of call out for leaders is if you are uncomfortable with conflict and you don't want to step into conversations, you're likely causing people to live in chronic pain. Please don't let your level of discomfort cause other people to stay in pain. sometimes they are high stake conversations. Sometimes they are uncomfortable conversations for you. They might be uncomfortable conversations for other people, but you can do it anyway. You know, I think there's a book out there, like Feel the Pain and Do It Anyway. I will just say that I think it's the rare person that's completely comfortable having these conversations. I sure still get nervous doing conversations, and I do it anyway, because it's a sign that something important is at stake. And so think of that, the discomfort is your body and your psyche telling you that something important is at stake. And part of the job is stepping into it. And I'll give like a little sub point. It doesn't have to be a one and done conversation. I think that that's a misnomer. Working relationships are ongoing relationships. So it's unlikely that one boo-boo or not handling something artfully is going to be catastrophic.
Great point. That puts more pressure on it, doesn't it? If it's a single conversation expectation.
Yeah. And you're in a relationship. It's not a single conversation. It's an everyday type of you're in a relationship with your board and with your directors and with your employees every day. So think about that as, you know, every day is an opportunity to be able to have a conversation. And I'll quote one of my friends who would say, you know, we don't have problems. If you come and talk to me about stuff, you know, then there won't be any problems. It's when you come and don't talk to me that there right. become problems. So think about that as, you know, an executive director, you know, talk about the small stuff. Don't get bogged down in the small stuff. Your managers, your supervisors, your directors, that's their lane that they get to swim in for that. But just don't set the expectation that there's going to be a big conversation. I think that is too intimidating for a lot of people and they'll sidestep it.
So well put, Carol. Once again, you've referenced a couple of great resources. I know you will talk about more, and of course, you knew this was coming. I've asked every guest on this podcast to share a book that has been meaningful to them. Do you have a recommendation for our listeners?
Oh, I have so many.
That's a hard question, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So one of them that's at the top of the stack that I honestly have not read, but I want to give a shout out to Human Services organization that I did a training during one of their all-day retreats for like 400 people in management and supervisory relationship. This gentleman came up to me afterward and said, hey, I just want to share with you, there was this one book that someone recommended to me. And I grabbed it. I don't think I've actually read anything past the first five or six pages, but I just love having the title. It's like, and it's called, I Don't Have to Make Everything Better.
The title alone is worth it, right?
Its title alone is worth it. And then also really anything by Stone and Heen. They have one book called Thanks for the Feedback. And the subtitle is Even When It's, you know, basically unfair, stupid, or not deserved. I like that. And they have and Stone and Heen also have another one whose title escapes me right now, but it's one of my favorites about conflict resolution. Actually, it's within arm's reach.
Let's find it. As we record, we'll get it in front of our audience.
Okay. So of course it's, I don't know about your audience, but I'm like a geek for buying books. My bookshelf used to be like 60% read, 40% not read. And now it's kind of switched because I just love.
You keep getting books. Right.
I'm like, oh, this sounds so great. And people give me, you know, information. Okay.
That's okay. Well, you got one. Yeah. What is it?
Difficult Conversations, How to Discuss What Matters Most by Douglas Stone, Bruce Patton, and Sheila Heen. And I know it's one of my favorites because I'm going to give a shout out to my high school English teacher, Mr. Poe, who always said, you read with a pen in hand. And I've circled, I've starred, I've highlighted, I've asterisked, I've written notes in the margin. There were a couple of pages in the back that were completely blank. And I was processing work with a particular client. And so I'm writing all over the back, couple of pages. And so it's kind of become, you know, a little bit of a go-to for me. you know, and then also The Art of Mediation by the National Institute of Trial Advocacy, which was my first manual for mediation training. Not sure if it's still in print. It's a little bit more kind of technical, but those are really good. Those are really good.
It's a host of good recommendations, Carol. So we'll have to take it back to the committee for review and decide which one will feature on your website post as it relates to this episode. But of course, we can name many of them, and thank you for that. Speaking of a final call to action, where can our listeners go to find out more about you and the great work you're doing?
So a couple of different places. I'm on most social media, including my own YouTube channel, where I put out little vignettes to help people increase their conflict resolution muscles. You can find me at managingconflict.com. And you can also find me on LinkedIn, where several years ago, someone identified me as one of the top 30 people to follow for conflict resolution. So any of those places, I curate, I put stuff out, all designed to help people increase their conflict resolution confidence, and also their conflict resolution competency.
Perfect, Carol. We will happily link up those resources and make it easy for our listeners to find you. And once again, thanks for all of your advice and for joining me on the path.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Carol as much as I did and found it both insightful and empowering. Her expertise in conflict resolution is going to give you something to help you next address a situation that will occur inevitably at your nonprofit. Now, for more information about Carol and her work and more about this episode number 256, just go to the podcast page at pmanonprofit.com. You can navigate your way to this episode and find the show notes and get lots of information that Carol and I discussed. Recommendations, references, and resource links. Now, if you found this episode as helpful as I think you did, please share it with somebody else on the path. They can benefit from Carol's expertise as well, and you will help us introduce other nonprofit leaders to our community and this podcast. Now, also, if you haven't subscribed to this podcast, just go to that same podcast page at pmanonprofit.com and hit the follow button. That'll make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. They come out every Thursday. Of course, on that podcast page, you can also hit the episodes button and go back through any of our episodes throughout the library of this podcast and search by guest name or by topic. And one other reminder, don't forget to sign up for our Thursday Leadership Lens email newsletter. It's new and improved. And it not only includes information from these podcasts, but also just good leadership content that will help you on your path to nonprofit leadership. Just go again to pmanonprofit.com to subscribe today. Thanks one more time for all that you're doing in the nonprofit sector. Keep up the good work for causes that are most meaningful to you. I'll keep bringing you content to help you do it even better. Have a great week. I'll see you next time on the path.